WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Academy Award winner Alex Gibney is a prolific director of documentaries such as Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, the Oscar-winning Taxi to the Dark Side. Last year, he joined us in the green space for our first live show with an audience to talk about The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley, about Elizabeth Holmes. And now Gibney has a new film, Citizen K, which opens at Film Forum January 15th. Citizen K looks at the rise, fall, and second act of an infamous Russian oligarch, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, via his journey from an ambitious small-time business guy who saw the possibilities of unfettered capitalism to an oil tycoon to a prisoner to a political activist in exile. The film looks at how the privatization of Russian industry helped bring Putin to power and how Putin ensured he would stay in power. The film was just nominated by the Writers Guild for Best Documentary Screenplay, and we are thrilled that Alex Gibney is back on all of it. Alex, welcome back.
Thanks, Allison.
So what brought you to this story? Of all the stories you tell?
Well, it's not a surprise to think that after 2016, thoughts began drifting toward Russia. And it occurred to me that we didn't know that much about how Russia worked. Some people did, but broadly speaking, we didn't. And so I was interested in that idea. And some friends of mine, producers PJ's Van Sandvik and John Batzik, had been following the Khodorkovsky story for some time and suggested that I might be interested. And I dug in, and I was.
Had you ever heard of Khodorkovsky before?
I had heard of him, but I can't say I knew that much about him. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't know that much about that unusual period in Russia, the sort of post-Soviet period. We know a lot about Gorbachev, mm-hmm. you know, the fall of the wall, all that in East Berlin, but the idea of what happened between the end of communism and Putin, we didn't know that much about. So for all those reasons, plus a way of getting to understand Putin from somebody who was his chief rival in some ways, mm-hmm. that was very appealing to me.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We get a great history lesson into the Soviet Union and into Russia, and it tracks with Khodorkovsky's own rise.
Yes.
Explain to folks how that is, why you start the doc with the fall of the Soviet Union and where Khodorkovsky is at that time.
Well, this film is really a lot of about a lot of falls and rises, and you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a decision made that they were going to go cold turkey free market capitalism. But nobody in Russia really knew how that was supposed to work.
Or the other version of that is mainline capitalism.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So as a result, you know, there were a number of people who were opportunistic, shall we say, and took great advantage of this moment. And Khodorkovsky was one of them. He rose very quickly to enormous riches and then made a kind of unholy bargain with Boris Yeltsin, who in 1996 was facing re-election. And Khodorkovsky and a number of other oligarchs, seven of whom, by the way, controlled 50% of Russia's economy, made a deal with Yeltsin to basically say, look, we'll bankroll your re-election campaign and you desperately need us in exchange for you putting up for collateral on these loans some of Russia's biggest state-owned enterprises. And one of them was a huge oil company called Yukos, which is what Khodorkovsky ended up with.
So for the average Russian, as this capitalism is this like tsunami of money to them, what might not seem like a lot to us, comes into the country, they get these vouchers, this history of this voucher system. What were the vouchers supposed to do? And what did Khodorkovsky see as a possibility in these vouchers?
Okay, so for a lot of small government enterprises, the Soviet Union decided to give everybody a piece of this new capitalism. So everybody was given a voucher, and the vouchers were kind of like stocks. And there was an ostensible value of them. And so you could either sell them to somebody, sell them back to a bank, if you could find a bank, or you could hang on to them and hope that they would be worth a lot of money in the future. Well, most people, I mean, particularly people who could barely eat at the time, you know, didn't know what this was and didn't have any idea what a stock market was. So somebody like Hodakovsky, what he did is he started collecting them. And he collected them by offering very small amounts of money for these vouchers. And the next thing he knew, he was acquiring huge stakes in a whole bunch of different companies. And he started to use that to get more and more powerful. And he acquired a bank called Menatep, which then started doing business for the state. So this whole voucher system really caught the citizens of Russia completely unprepared, because they didn't know how capitalism works. They were just thrust into a world they had no knowledge of. People like Hodakovsky understood how it worked and took advantage.
And he doesn't necessarily in the film feel like he took advantage. At least that's how he says, well, I paid them X for this.
He doesn't feel that way. But I think, I mean, you'd have to look at it as kind of exploitation. He was opportunistic and ruthless. And as a result, he got ahead. He got ahead very fast. And you know, you can blame the Russian state for having made foolish decisions about how to price their assets. And all of that is true. At the same time, Hodakovsky was ruthless in terms of how he acquired an enormous grub stake in a whole bunch of companies.
My guest is Alex Gibney. We're talking about his new film, Citizen K, which opens at Film Forum on January 15th. And the reason it's Citizen K is, even though we're saying Hodakovsky, it's Khodorkovsky. So this deal that Yeltsin made to keep power, why, you know, this may sound like a really ignorant question, but why didn't anyone stop this?
Well,
I thought to myself, how did this
because continue? It was kind of a backroom deal. It's like, how do you stop a backroom deal? And Yeltsin, of course, was in power at the time, but he had an approval rating of something like 3%. It was that low. I mean, he was really in the toilet, and he was in very bad physical shape. He was drinking a lot, and it looked like a man named Zhuganov was going to beat him in the election. Now, Zhuganov was a communist, which meant taking Russia right back to state run economy that it had been in. And so there was this huge debate, and Americans to some extent got involved, and certainly the powers that were in Russia, very wealthy businessmen, didn't want to see communism come back. So in a backroom deal, they made a deal to basically say, we will funnel cash in your direction, but on one condition. And the condition was that they got paid for doing that. I mean, you know, we're familiar with very wealthy people in this country funding campaigns, sometimes through all sorts of dark money that we don't really know about. But it's rare that there's an immediate cash payback. I mean, there may be a quid pro quo, to use a term that we're becoming more and more familiar with, but not a cash payback. That's what happened in Russia.
Possible ambassadorship, but nothing like what we've seen. So I want to talk about Mikhail Khodorkovsky. A T Magazine profile of you said this: you've made a, quote, career of exploring the shadowy contradictions in human behavior at the porous boundaries between good and bad. How does Mikhail Khodorkovsky embody these qualities?
Which ones?
The contradictions.
Well, he is a contradictory character. I mean, he was a guy who saw capitalism as a game. And I think he was just one of those people who was good at playing the game. And that game in that period in Russia meant being extraordinarily ruthless. Mm-hmm. Post 2000, or particularly post 98, after Russia comes out of its terrifying brush with low oil prices and the ruble falling through the floor, Hodakovsky realizes that there may be a better way to do things, that there is a value to rules. There's a value to the rule of law. There's a value to economic transparency. And so he begins to campaign for greater and greater democracy and more civic values. And this makes him go toe-to-toe with Putin, who sees now and Putin comes to power in 2000. He's appointed by Yeltsin, literally at the edge of Y2K, and he sees Hodorkovsky as a very wealthy man who is becoming a political rival, and they go toe-to-toe. So the contradiction in Hodorkovsky is a man who, on the one hand, you know, is ruthless in terms of his acquisition of wealth, but on the other hand, is smart enough, and he's a tremendously intelligent guy, to see outside of his own greed.
Two things. One is, do you think Putin helped make Hodorkovsky a better man?
Well,
because of who Putin was, how he behaved, and what Hodorkovsky thought about it.
I think peculiarly, Putin makes Hodorkovsky a better man when he puts Hodorkovsky in prison. That's a cruel thing to say, but as part of this rivalry, in 2003, Putin's solution to this problem of Hodorkovsky is to put him in prison. Hodorkovsky goes to prison for tax evasion, which was kind of a joke because nobody knew what what laws, mm-hmm. what tax evasion laws were. And then that sentence was then later compounded by accusing Hodorkovsky of stealing his own oil, which is an impossibility. And if he had stolen his own oil, how could he have sold it in the first place? So, it's while he's in prison facing the possibility that he might spend the rest of his life there. And this is a far-flung prison by...
The desert by China.
Yeah, it's by China, Mongolia. It's near a huge uranium mine. It took 2 days for his family to get there if they wanted to visit him from Moscow. Hodorkovsky begins to see things very differently. He begins to see the perils of... an oligarchy, and what happens when the rule of law is subsumed to someone's personal sense of political power. And he begins to understand what it means to be a political dissident and how important civic-minded views are. And by the way, he puts his life on the line. A couple of times, people in his company were threatened with what you might say were mortal consequences, mm-hmm. and Hodorkovsky goes on hunger strikes. In fact, I didn't even know what a dry hunger strike was until Hodorkovsky told me about it. That's where you don't accept food or water, and you can die within about 3 days. And he succeeds each time in terms of getting better treatment for people who are close to him. So he was willing to put his life on the line. Well, sometimes when the only power you have is to end your own life, it changes you. And I think Hodorkovsky did come out of prison a very changed man. And over the course of his prison time, he started writing letters, he started communicating with the outside world, and he goes from ruthless oligarch to powerful political dissident. And it's a very interesting turn.
It's an interesting transition. I want to go back to something you said early on in your answer, just so people are clear. Why was Hodorkovsky problematic for Putin?
Well,
in Putin's version
he was problematic for Putin for a couple of reasons. Number one, he started using his money to buy up influence in the Duma, the Russian representative body, but also because Hodorkovsky was suggesting that it was going to be better, and it certainly would have been better for him, but it's going to be better for the Russian economy to open itself to the outside world. If you open yourself to the outside world, and Hodorkovsky was pursuing a merger with Exxon, if you open yourself to the outside world, you have to operate according to laws and customary standards, and you can't play the kind of backdoor dealing games that people were used to playing in Russia, and Putin was now playing with a whole new group of oligarchs. So that kind of transparency was not going to be good for Putin long term, and it certainly wasn't going to be good for him to have a political rival like Hodorkovsky, who might have been able to capitalize on his wealth to become Putin's replacement.
My guest is Alex Gibney. We're discussing his new documentary, Citizen Gay. Citizen K. That would be a whole other Russian documentary. We know about their civil rights issues. Alex Gibney's my guest. We'll have more after the break. This is All of It. My guest is Alex Gibney. We're talking about his new film, Citizen K. It opens at Film Forum on January 15th. This looks at the rise, fall, and the second act of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. So when we're talking about Khodorkovsky, we learned so much about Putin as well in this, and about a phrase I'd never heard, Russian electoral theater. Let's talk about that first. In terms of the elections in Russia, if you were to turn on the television and watch a debate, what would I see?
Well, you might see a woman throwing water in someone's face and people screaming at each other in a kind of wild, no holds barred, debate, which makes things look very vital and vibrant. It's like, wow, what a democracy. But in Russia, they call it election theater. And there's a sardonic cast to that idea. And the notion is it's not real. It's just pretend. There's conflict, but there's no there. And the one person, of course, who's missing at those debates is the person who's always going to win the election. That's Vladimir Putin. And so this whole idea of election theater is to put up a kind of chimera, a kind of fake democracy that allows people to believe they're in a democracy when they're not. And it's interesting why that is. I mean, Russia's not North Korea, you know, and I think it's important, that kind of illusion, even though everyone kind of agrees that it's an illusion. Nobody's under any illusion that Putin's going to win, but they somehow need this shadow puppet play to take place in order to make the whole thing. And I think Putin needs it in order to feel that he's somehow legitimate.
It was interesting in the film, you really get the sense of how important image is to Putin, that not only was Khodorkovsky practically a threat to him, but anything that threatened the image of who he was and who he created himself to be, because he was kind of a fixer before he rose to power. He was a bureaucrat, you know, not inconsequential, but not somebody you'd necessarily think, oh, that guy's going to end up being the president and ruling with an iron fist. And I thought it was also interesting in film, I don't know if you did this on purpose, his physical transformation was kind of stunning, as was Khodorkovsky's. Mm-hmm. So when we first see the first stills of Putin, he's kind of doughy.
Very doughy and very sort of...
Schlumpy.
Schlumpy would be a good word. Yeah, but over time he builds himself up. And frankly, image is important to Putin in a very fundamental way too, which is he understands how important it is to manufacture an image. He's appointed president, but very quickly thereafter, you know, there are images of him on TV pointing guns, strutting around, you know, telling people that he's going to, you know, bomb the Chechens, you know, even in the toilet, you know, he's going to kill them. And then, of course, he takes over two of the TV stations. Now, say what you like about the Wild West capitalism of the 90s. It was ruthless. It was brutal. But in some ways, it was magnificent because there was an enormous amount of press freedom, particularly on television. But Putin ends that and takes over the two biggest networks and turns them into state organs of propaganda, mostly celebrating Vladimir Putin. And you're right. Over time, he becomes bigger and bigger, more physically imposing. Now he's playing hockey. Now he's, you know, pulling huge fish out of lakes and oceans.
Yeah, all those horseback riding photos make more sense to me now.
Yes.
And not just a punchline. It's like, oh, wait, this is part of a long evolution for this man.
Yeah, he's kind of like 007 now.
Yeah.
Now, and you're right. I mean, where he came from was as a kind of, I mean, he was KGB, but a kind of low-level KGB and a kind of a guy you'd go to be the behind-the-scenes fixer. You know, he gets stuff done. You know, when he becomes president, he undergoes this transformation, which is still present to this day.
So we see his transformation, and we also see Mikhail's transformation, because in the beginning, some of the stills, he reminded me a little bit, was it Dan Aykroyd and Steve Martin, Two Wild and Crazy Guys? Like, sort of when he first gets money.
He does. He's these sleazy leather jackets. You know, he's got this kind of... big mustache and these huge glasses, and he talks often about greed and how greed is good, and I like to be greedy, you know, nothing I like more than money. Who would want to exchange those bills for dirty products? I like to collect money, you know. It's kind of creepy, to be honest with you, and if you saw that guy, you know, selling watches on a street corner, you wouldn't be surprised. By the end, you know,
he has Steve Jobs looking era. You kind of
see him make a turn. Yes, he does. He's suddenly the rimless glasses. He's a very handsome man, very charismatic, and by the time he gets out of prison, noticeably more slender, but also sort of more gaunt, and in a way, has a kind of faraway look that bespeaks of a kind of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. He's become a very different kind of a character. So he undergoes his own transformation. I think one of the reasons that, you know, he's let out of prison in 2013 by a pardon, and of course Khodorkovsky doesn't even find out about it except on television. He's in prison one day and he finds out that he and Pussy Riot have been released. I think Putin let him out because it was more dangerous to have him as a martyr inside Russia than it was to have him outside, where he couldn't influence anybody, mm-hmm. in terms of a sense of resistance to his regime.
Because of what has happened with him, and because he's still a wanted man in Russia.
He's now wanted for murder in Russia. Now, this is a strange circumstance. Way back in the late 90s, there was a lot of conflict between Khodorkovsky, who was laying off tens of thousands of people, you know, from his oil firm because they were facing terribly low oil prices and the ruble going through the floor. A mayor in a town called Neftyugansk was shot and killed. His brains spilled out on the pavement, as was described to Khodorkovsky on Khodorkovsky's birthday. And it's customary for people sometimes to kill people who are opposed to them on birthdays. So there was a suspicion, but nothing ever proven. And then somehow over time, there's a whole shifting set of characters of people behind this murder. They go through, you know, maybe 10 different kinds of people who actually did this deed. And finally they settle, that is to say the authorities settle on Khodorkovsky. It was Khodorkovsky who did it. He was the one who planned it. And so now a murder charge is hanging over Khodorkovsky's head. But that didn't happen until after he left the country.
And he lives in England now.
He does. He lives in London. He runs an organization called Open Russia. And Open Russia is very much an organization dedicated to promoting civic values in Russia, but also to doing a lot of helping expose corruption inside Russia and, frankly, to fight strenuously against the Putin regime.
Is his life in danger on a day-to-day basis?
It's been said that there is a kill order targeting Khodorkovsky. Now, Khodorkovsky deals with this in a very macho way. He said, look, I'm not going to surround myself with bodyguards. And indeed, I walked around London with him, and there were no people with earpieces in their ear anywhere that I could see. If, you know, they decide, says Khodorkovsky, they're going to kill me, they're going to kill me. And I think it is possible that there are those who might want to kill Khodorkovsky, and sometimes at the behest or in order to please perhaps the boss. And other Russians have been killed in the United Kingdom. Many. Mm-hmm. Litvinenko would be one. The attempted murder of the Skripals would be another instance. Even Khodorkovsky's lawyer mysteriously died in a plane crash, or a helicopter crash, I should say. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that Khodorkovsky would be killed, but he has decided he's not going to live his life in fear. He's just going to move around. You can see him walking around the city with a little backpack over his shoulder, often accosted by Russians who want to take selfies with him.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. My guest is Alex Gibney. The name of his film is Citizen K. How much time did you spend with Mikhail Khodorkovsky?
Well, the formal interviews, I would say we shot about, I guess it would have been about 8 days of formal interviews. Mm. Four of those before I went to Russia, and four of those after I came back. And then I walked around with him, you know, spent time with him doing this or that. But, you know, that's a lot. That's a long interview. Mm-hmm. And I think over time, I wouldn't say I got to know him well, but I got to know him well enough. He's a very intriguing man, very protective of his own space. But also one of the things that impressed me about him was, unlike powerful people I have interviewed, and Khodorkovsky still has access to an enormous fortune, $500 million, which is a jump change according to what he once owned, but quite a bit of money for any of us. Khodorkovsky answered every question I put to him. Now, I may not have agreed with some of his answers, but there were no ground rules. There was no imperiousness. Any question I asked him, he answered, and forthrightly. So that I really appreciated, and that's not the case with a lot of powerful people in this territory.
What was something that you discovered in Russia or you learned in Russia that changed or had an impact on the second set of interviews?
Well, one of the things I learned was that in Russia, particularly outside of the main cities, Khodorkovsky is reviled. He's not well-liked, and Putin is well-liked.
And you show this in the film.
I do. Mm-hmm. And that was really interesting for me to see. Now, I think Khodorkovsky even has a hard time accepting that. It is true that a lot of that is due to propaganda, but it's also true that people have, average everyday people have very negative memories of those 90s because things weren't so nice for, your man or your woman on the street. You know, suddenly things weren't provided for you. You had to work for them. Not only that, but because of the ruthless nature of capitalism, just as, we see some evidence of in our own country, prices could go, hugely high one day and might not be able to afford anything. Bread might not be in the stores. Things went according to the rules of capitalism, not according to the rules of need. And that was tough for people to see. And so for average people, these ruthless oligarchs who made billions and control 50% of the economy, even today, Putin uses that era as a kind of propaganda message, even though he's created a whole new set of sort of oligarchs 2.0. But that period is one that is a very powerful political medicine in Russia.
Yeah, one of the people says, I like stability.
Right.
Putin makes things stable.
He did. And, one of the things, I think it's fair to say that when Putin took over, things took a turn for the better in Russia. I think there were, he came across early on as a reformer. Also, he greatly benefited from the fact that oil prices soared just as he was coming into power. But I think, people just looked around them and see, geez, since this guy Putin has come in, I'm doing a lot better than I used to be able to be doing under, say, Yeltsin.
You touch very briefly towards the end on Russia's involvement in the 2016 election. What was it like to be making this film during this period of time when we here in the United States are very concerned, some of us are very concerned, about foreign interference in the election?
Well, I purposely didn't mention the word Trump once in the film. I wanted to get away from Trump and this the way he sucks all the attention all the time. That said, I think that one of the interesting things about doing this film and where we came out on it was that you can see a lot of what Trump is doing in Vladimir Putin. Particularly the utter disregard for truth in Russia, the sort of, kind of making the rule of law utterly pliant and bending its knee to the state. That's something I think Trump would like to do, has not yet achieved. But particularly this idea of how to go after the press, how to try to control truth and make it almost irrelevant. And I think the other thing, too, is to demonize the other in ways that Trump often does. So a lot of these things you see as not as evidence of collusion, but as a kind of harmony of the political economy that Trump might like to pursue.
I got a sense of why Putin and Trump might just really just get along.
I think that's true.
Aside from all of the political machinations and who's controlling whom, they just might get along.
I think they see things in a similar way. And in some ways, it's as simple as what's good for Russia is good for me, or what's good for the United States is good for me, the American oligarch, Donald Trump.
You just gave me the best segue ever. Alex Gibney is the director of Citizen K. It opens at Film Forum on January 15th. It is a very smart movie. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Allison.
Coming up, Peabody Award-winning journalist and creator of the Trump Inc. podcast, WNYC's Andrea Bernstein kicks off our week-long series about her new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.